He rose from poverty on a farm near Terre Haute to win a gold medal in the Olympics in Australia. But that was only part of his long journey. One of nine children, he didn't grow up with much, but he had room to roam on that farm and developed a work ethic. His family had to move into Terre Haute when the government wanted to turn the family farm into a munitions depot, but it turned out to be the best thing for him. That got him involved in organized sports, and he turned out to be an outstanding long jumper, good enough to finish second in the state high school track meet. He was drafted into the armed services from there, where he was able to continue developing his skills, and by the time he got home again, both his body and his confidence were soaring. He went back to work, though, with no intentions of attending college, but a local doctor making a house call convinced him to go to Indiana University. There, he became a self-taught world-class leaper and won the gold medal in the 1956 Olympics in Melbourne. How good was he? His NCAA long jump record stood for 7 years, and his IU record stood for 35 years. After the Olympics, he continued his education, became a dentist, and today, at the age of 81, he's still practicing at the state hospital in Logansport. It's been quite a ride, so let's go along. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Greg Bell.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
Okay, today's one-on-one episode comes to you from the home of Greg Bell, Olympic gold medalist in the 1956 Olympics as a long jumper, now still a practicing dentist in Logansport, Indiana. And Greg, we got a lot to go through. I'm going to jump right into this. You're born in Terre Haute, Indiana on a 36-acre truck farm, and I'm not sure what a truck farm is.
Well, it's just about what the name implies. My father only had a fifth grade education, but he had been a farmer all his life, and his livelihood came from growing vegetables and fruits, selling them at the wholesale growers market, and he delivered them there with a small truck, hence the name truck farm.
Okay, so it was a vegetable farm, but
yes,
but he delivers it with trucks. Gotcha. So I know your family moved into, you're one of nine kids.
Yes.
Your family had to move into what's described as a chicken house for a 12-year period. How old were you when that happened?
Very young. I was probably a year or thereabouts.
Okay.
But what I do know is that our house burned. I had gone into Terre Haute with my parents on one of the infrequent trips we made to buy some of the things that we didn't grow. And when we came back, there is no house. The older kids, as near as I can get the story, were left to detassel some corn. And I guess during a break, they found that dried corn silks and catalpa beans made some pretty good cigar and cigarette substitutes.
Ooh.
And it looked like one of them found its way into a clothes hamper or something.
So one of your brothers,
yes,
apparently started this fire.
No one ever admitted.
Of course. Of course not. Wow.
But yeah, it was just an accidental fire that began.
So without insurance or anything like that, your family is forced to move into a...
a chicken house. Now, I've seen in print, it's talk about chicken coops, which is misleading because a chicken coop to me is a small rectangular thing where you have a dozen chickens. Now, this was a rather large chicken house because this was part of our meat source as well. So we had quite a few chickens. And so it was a house probably about 20 by 40, which is why we were able to utilize it for a house. So with many cans of Lewis Lye, which probably no one even knows about now, which Mom also used for making soap.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of work, the chicken house was scrubbed out. The chickens got evicted, and we moved in. And Dad partitioned the house along its length about a third of the way in, and then divided that into stalls, which would accommodate a double bed. So there were four of those, and we slept three to a bed. My mother and father and the youngest child slept in one bedroom, and my two brothers, just older than I, slept in the next bed. And there was another little bitty stall that a third brother slept in, or the fourth one, and then the three girls slept in the end bedroom. So this is how we lived. The rest of the house was divided into two rooms, a living room, and that's stretching a point, and a kitchen. Our bathtub was a number three tub, voice tub, and you hoped that on Saturdays you weren't the last one in.
Man, so like, I mean, was it well heated and all this?
Or? Well, it was heated by an old warm morning stove and that was banked at night during the cold season. And the kitchen range was heated alternately with coal and wood, whichever we had available. And one of my jobs became going to the pump and filling up a water bucket in the kitchen, and cold mornings I'd have to go out and break the ice out of the water bucket because it had frozen. So, yeah, often it was not warm in there. But we were crowded. I've joked about the crowded conditions, saying that if I had to get up during the middle of the night, I'd need to leave a bookmark to find my place again. But the one thing that we had in our family was love. We had the usual squabbles with kids, but nothing of any serious nature. And of course, we lived in a rural area, so we were fortunate we were not subjected to all the slings and arrows that you find in urban settings.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate, too, at the time, because prejudice was running very high in 1930. And we would go to school. We were the only black family in Pimento School. And we got the usual insults. A lot of them were curbed because my older sister could whip most of the boys in the area. So she usually handled the real altercations. But we had the usual things. But there were some offsetting factors, too. In fact, my brother, just older than I, developed a friendship with a young man who were reasonably well off. And he would often bring two apples and give one to Stuart. Or finally, he implored his mother to start fixing an additional lunch that he brought for my brother. So these were the pleasant memories that we found in the midst of all this. And so we had a reasonably happy lifestyle because I never knew anything better.
Yeah.
I spent the first 12 years of my life in the chicken house, and the first six of those, we didn't have electricity. So one of my jobs as a small child was cleaning the kerosene lamp chimneys. And I'd better exercise a lot of care, too, because had I broken one, we didn't have money to replace them.
So when did you begin competing in organized sports? Sorry, okay. High school, I guess?
Yeah, and it was
Terre Haute Garfield.
Yeah, it wasn't until my sophomore year. In 1942, our family felt very devastated, and we were, because my dad was 70 at the time. And
your dad was 70 in 1942?
Yeah.
How old was your dad when you were born?
1930, yeah, so
58.
12 years, yeah.
He was 58 when you were born.
Yeah.
Wow. And you were not the youngest.
No. I have two younger than I.
Yeah. He kept busy.
Yeah, he did. But we got an announcement in 1942 during World War II at its height that the government had decided, formless, faceless government, and decided we probably need to build an ammunition depot far removed from the seat of government in the event that Germany should attack us. We don't want them to know where it is. So they took about 400,000 acres of some of the best farmland in Vigo County in the Terre Haute area that you had to move. Well, we have no money, had no thought of moving anywhere else ever, and I think we were probably the last families out of this area called the Underwood Settlement. This was one of the first black settlements in that part of the country. And day after day, mounted guards would come and say, "You have to leave. We have no place to go." I think finally, and they made the settlement, and we got something like $1,500 for everything that we had. What do you buy for $1,500?
Right.
And we didn't even know where to go. So we were about 10 miles south of Terre Haute. And finally, my father had a sister who lived in Terre Haute, and they helped scout around. Finally found a house that we could probably buy with what little we had. On the outskirts of Terre Haute, on the north side, a little place called Highland. It would have been a ghetto if there had been enough people in it to make it a ghetto.
Yeah, you need people for a ghetto, don't you?
Yeah, you do. Because that area was comprised of about 8 or 10 families, and everyone else who lived in that area were related to one or another of those families. So it wasn't a very big neighborhood. But this is where we moved to. it turned out to be a great move for me eventually, because at first I thought it was terrible because I went to a little black two-room high school then. I had just finished the sixth grade at Pimento. And we moved up there, and I'm in the seventh grade, and I'm already going over some of the stuff they're teaching. Mm. They were behind.
Okay.
Which puts me in good shape, but even at such a young age, I realized, and this is a handicap. So I went 2 years there, and then as a freshman, we went to Rankin Junior High School, just a little bit farther north of that, still on the north side of Terre Haute, and that was only 1 year, the freshman year. So then I went to Garfield, and that turned out to be the lucky break for me, because I only then realized as a sophomore there was such a thing as organized track. So I had always enjoyed outrunning most of the people I could meet, especially my older brothers. They'd do something I didn't like, and I would give them a rock fit and then outrun them. So that worked out pretty well. So I had known that I could run. So, say, this is pretty good. It's not going to be bad going to high school. Get a chance to run.
Bell meets the man who changes the direction of his life, and he becomes a self-taught, world-class long jumper when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith, talking this week with the gold medalist in the long jump in the 1956 Olympics, Terre Haute native Greg Bell. He began his high school track career as a pole vaulter, but a back injury led him toward the long jump pit, and despite a limited background in the sport, he finished second in the state track meet in 1948. He figured that would be the end of his athletic career, and he worked blue-collar jobs for a couple of years, but then was drafted into the Army in 1950. He was stationed in Germany and then transferred to France, where once again the construction of a munitions depot altered the course of his life. While helping construct one in southern France, he learned of an armed forces track meet. He won that and then won the European Championship, jumping 18 inches longer than he had in high school. Still, he thought his jumping career was over when he returned to Terre Haute. He took a job for $1.69 an hour at the Alice Chambers plant and later, on a whim, began working out on his own at his former high school track. Soon thereafter, he won the state AAU meet in Muncie with a record jump, but still had no plans to do anything but continue to work in a factory. But then, he developed tonsillitis, and, well, let's let Greg Bell pick up the story from here.
And it was about this time that I developed one of my yearly cases of tonsillitis. It really knocked me out, and I was still living at home with my mother and the younger brothers and sisters that were still at home. And so I'm laying around there moaning, and she said, I'm going to call Dr. Bannon. I said, Mom, you don't know a doctor will make a house call for you. She said, Dr. Bannon will for me. This man was a relatively new doctor in town, later became really popular. In fact, he was on, I believe he was a trustee for Indiana University for a long while, one of the best recruiters they ever had, because he really had a fondness for athletics. Never competed himself. So I didn't know this about him at the time, but he came to the door of the old house on North 14th Street, and someone had given Mom an old piano, one of the big uprights, and I had this little trophy here sitting on it. Mm-hmm. One of my most favorite keepsakes, because this is where it all started.
1952.
Yeah. So Dr. Bannon saw that. And right away he saw, you sir, U.S. Army Championship Europe.
I guess you, yeah.
And he said, whose is that? Mom said, it's Greg's. First, you may or may not want to edit this, but the first words this man ever said to me, he came to the door of the bedroom that I shared with three siblings, said, get your ass out of that bed and go to school. You have some talent. What's this man talking about? I'm dying without one. And he's telling me to go to school. I never dreamed of going to school anywhere else because this just isn't what my family did. And he kept pushing it, and he would make it a point to keep track of what I was doing. And I had competed in some more AAU meets, and I kept getting better. And this man hounded me for the next year and a half till I finally agreed, and let's give it a start. As you might imagine, I was very reluctant because by this time, I got a good job at Alice Chalmers, and I worked my way all the way up to $1.69 an hour.
You were rich.
And you want me to give this up for what?
For studying?
Yeah. And I didn't even know what. What am I going to study? So finally, I decided to give it a try. In the meantime, he had taken me to St. Louis for my first national AAU meet. And I tied for third. And it wasn't just that I tied for third in the national meet. The man that I tied with was Meredith Gordine, who had placed second in the 1952 Olympics. Boy, I'm up here with a big boy now.
Yeah.
So that gave me some impetus. So I finally decided we'll try going to school. So he took me to IU and introduced me to Gordon Fisher. And Dr. Bannon had told Gordon Fisher, you better grab this young man. He's going to be a great one. And I don't know how much he believed him, and maybe not a great deal, because Bill Bannon had also, at his own expense, brought Charlie Dumas to Indiana University. And he told him how great he was going to be. And as you may remember, he became the world's first 7-foot high jumper.
Oh, okay.
He was on the 56 team with me. And no one seemed that interested in...
Where did he go to school?
California.
California. Yeah. Could have gone to Indiana if they wanted him.
Yes, he could have. That's one that got away.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much Gordon thought that he had in me, but Bannon recommended me very highly. And it turned out that my freshman year there was one of the worst years of my life. Freshmen couldn't compete in varsity competition. And it turns out I had started progressing very rapidly. I'm out jumping everybody in the Big Ten by a foot, and I can't compete. That was a bad year, but it was probably good for me, too, because, as I said earlier, I had no idea what I was going to school for. So since I have done a lot of sketching in my life, I'm always picking up a pencil, it's okay, I'll be a commercial artist. Took about a semester to slap that silly idea from my head, because I began to see very quickly, even if I had great talent, without the proper connections, you would starve to death. So I started looking around for other things. Several of my friends tried to push me into medicine. And I probably could have got into med school because the head of the admission committee was the head of the infirmary there on campus, and he thought very highly of me. Why didn't you go to med school? He'd cuss me weekly. It didn't really interest me because, as my wife will tell you, I'm basically impatient by nature. And I reasoned that if I'm a physician, you come to me with your set of symptoms, and I prescribe a course of treatment, now I have to wait and see what I've done for you. And that didn't appeal to me. And then I started looking at dentistry. This is a perfect outlet for any artistic ability I have. I'm getting immediate feedback. I've extracted a tooth, I have restored one, I have made a denture, I've done all these things, and I can see immediately what I've done. Mm-hmm. So the farther I got into it, the more natural it seemed. Except, I found out as a freshman at IU, I was required to take, and I had told you earlier I had no background in math or science. As a freshman, I was required to take algebra, trigonometry, and chemistry. Oh my God, what am I into? I will never forget my first chemistry class. At the end of the class, the instructor said, I want you to balance these 6 equations for tomorrow's homework. And I looked at a classmate and said, what the hell is an equation? I did not know.
Yeah.
If you don't think that is a sphincter tightening experience.
Yeah.
So I was really sort of despondent, and I was about ready to give it up. And then I looked around me, and I got angry. I saw some people out there. They're not smart as I am, and they're making it. And I can. And I knew that Dr. Bannon was depending on me, as I can't let this man waste his time. So I started to knuckle down, and I learned an important truth. Just because I don't know something doesn't mean that I can't know. So that has been sort of a tenet with me now. What I don't know, I can know. And I worked by the end of my freshman year, I'd made the dean's list and actually attracted the attention of the president. He said, Herman B. Wells, it was a long time. He called me into his office. He said, Greg, I've been aware of your progress and track. Just want to let you know if you have a problem, my door is open. The president called me.
Yeah.
I didn't even know he was aware I had was alive. So I started competing, and my first trip to Madison Square Garden was as a freshman. Went to a national indoor AAU meet. And I really felt good because I got my first 25-foot jump and was beat 3/4 of an inch by Rosalind Range, who won the Pan Am Games that year. I said, well, I think I'm getting to the point where I can compete with some of the best of them now. So that gave me a lot of confidence. Enough so that the following June, I went to Boulder, Colorado for my first national outdoor championship. And I won it, but not only did I win it, I became the fifth man in the world to jump 26 feet.
And you're progressing not because of any great coaching, because you said the coach...
I have no coaching.
Yeah, you're just kind of figuring it out for yourself.
Yes, I began to be a student of long jumping, since it was obvious, but this time I have some ability. I happen to be the best sprinter IU had at that time, too, just incidentally. And I started watching all the world's top jumpers. Not that I wanted to copy what they were doing. I want to see what is it they are doing. And it soon occurred to me that there are three separate and distinct phases in a successful long jump. The approach, which must be fast but relaxed. The takeoff, which has to be explosive. And control of your body in the air. And landing position. And it soon became apparent to me, even the world's greatest jumpers often are losing a great deal in landing. So I started working on those phases. And...
Oh, yeah. And this is on your website, too.
Yes.
You're showing me a business card with, you know, all series of photographs of you as a long jumper sequence. Yeah. Yeah.
And as you can see, just before landing.
Your legs are extended.
Yes. And I wonder, how can I accomplish this? Because no one has strong enough abdominal muscles to go from here to there with their legs outstretched. But I started looking at the motion in the air. You turn this up, you'll see an almost perfect jackknife.
Uh-huh.
And it occurred to me, and in mid-jump, I'm like this. If I can snap the upper half of my body down and the lower half up with the proper timing, I can get this extension. And it worked.
Yeah.
Time after time, it worked. And suddenly, everybody in the world's looking at me.
So you were an innovator. You were probably the only person jumping this way.
I was. I got a lot of criticism. Sort of like Perry O'Brien did.
Whenever somebody does something differently, they're going to get some criticism for it.
Until you start beating everybody in the world.
Right.
Now this is the thing to do. And of course, that criticism never bothered me. In fact, it just made me have a little greater resolve for being critical. But I'm winning.
Greg Bell, country boy from outside of Terre Haute, Indiana, wins an Olympic gold medal and waxes poetic when one-on-one continues. But first, here's Milton Campbell, Bell's track teammate from IU, explaining how Bell's long jump instruction helped him win a gold medal in the decathlon in the 1956 Olympics.
I was self-coached, but, you know, in a funny sort of a way. I mean, I would get a hold of somebody like Greg Bell, and we worked out for 2-hour workouts. I mean, 2 1-hour workouts. And I put 2 feet more onto my long jump. So I would get a hold of these guys that knew what they were doing and say, hey, look, guys, can you help me with this?
Welcome back to One on One. I'm Mark Monteith, spending this hour with Olympic gold medalist Greg Bell. Keep in mind, all the podcasts for the One on One episodes are available on the website at 1070thefan.com. Just click on Shows, then click on Weekly Shows, click on the One on One link, and click on the Podcast link, and all the episodes are there for your listening pleasure. Now back to this week's guest, long jumper Greg Bell. who overcame bad conditions to win a gold medal in 1956. While some athletes find motivation from proving people wrong, Bell was able to find motivation from proving all the people who had faith in him to be right. Here comes the story and the poem.
You know, we haven't talked about your gold medal in the 1956 Olympics. Just tell me about your experience in those games. I mean, you're there, you win a gold, Milt Campbell, your IU teammate, won the decathlon in that Olympics. You guys were teammates and good friends, so getting something out of a drawer here.
Yes.
Yeah, that's your medal. I was going to ask you where your medal was. You keep it in a drawer here in a wooden thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I made this because they presented this to us in a little cheap plastic case, which fell apart soon.
So you've made a wooden...
So I made my own, container. And I decided, well, I won this in Australia, so let's make a map of Australia.
What was your jump? What was your best jump? In?
Not that great as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, it wasn't your best jump. I know.
No.
Your best jump was
26.7.
26.7.
Which I did twice, by the way.
And that stood as the longest jump for how many years? The world's best jump for like...
Well... I never quite broke Jesse Owens' record.
Oh, that's right. Jesse Owens said, yeah, yeah.
But I set a new NCAA record with it in 57, and it lasted for 7 years.
Okay. That's right. You had that jump into 57 NCAA meet, and it stood for 7 years.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then again, I jumped the same thing against Russia in 60.
Okay. Okay. But now, what was your Olympic gold medal winning jump?
25.8 1/4.
How much did you win by? Roughly.
6 inches.
Okay, pretty clear.
Yeah, it was not a real tight win, and I was a little frustrated, really, because I could jump better than that. But when the conditions are known, this was a horribly run Olympics. It was run, first of all, in the Melbourne Cricket Ground, which is circular. They had a long jump pit in the center approaching from both sides. They elected to have us run, I can't remember from which direction now, but they had imported two boatloads of crushed brick they thought was going to make this surface a lot faster. Well, it had been done too recently. So you could see big chunks of earth and cinders flying as people ran. And it was particularly difficult because there were at least three of us in that competition who had exceeded 26 feet. And so I had a clear win with 25.8 1/4, but the track was soft. The runway was too short. Three of us had to curve around the circular wall of the cricket grounds in order to get our normal length of run, mm-hmm. and then curve onto the runway. We were jumping into gusts of winds up to 35 miles an hour.
No.
it was just a total disaster. But the interesting thing is, even in spite of all this, I looked at the records. That was the second best jump in Olympic history.
Next to Jesse Owens.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
your performance was good.
Yeah, it was a good performance. It wasn't good in my estimation. It should have been better.
Yeah, not what you were hoping for, I'm sure.
But my feeling on winning was, this is something I think it almost has to be experienced to appreciate, but it was a feeling of euphoria, certainly. A feeling of extreme joy, vindication, I think, for all the people who had confidence in my ability to be able to do something like this, and to know that the whole world is looking at this little green country boy. And someone asked me once, how did you feel when you first entered the Olympic Stadium? And my feeling probably was similar to a lot of other people who are ashamed to say it. My first feeling was, what is a little green country boy with Commodore still between his toes doing down here aspiring to beat the best in the world? If you stop to think what you're asking of yourself, this is an awesome responsibility to say, I am better than everybody else on this planet. I had never dreamed of that. I never dreamed of being the best in the state of Indiana. These things happen. They don't just happen. Yes, God blessed me with the ability, but it didn't end there. I worked long and hard to do all this. I sacrificed, and many times I went out running after working till midnight in a snack bar trying to put some food on the table, and I did not feel like running, and my muscles ached, and cried for mercy. And I said, no, if you're going to be the best, then this is the price you have to pay.
Yeah.
I mentioned Dr. Bannon. Before I made the team, Dr. Bannon came by and said, Greg, make that team and I'll see you in Melbourne. And I thought, yeah, right. Dr. William G. Bannon took Greg Bell to dinner in Melbourne, Australia. This is why that I always urge people to remember those people who have influenced your life. And I wrote a piece that I will share with you because I think it's the greatest thing I will ever write, because I did it because of the inspiration Dr. Bannon gave me. And I called it, I Believe in You. There seems to be no limit as to what a man can do if he's buoyed up by the current of an I Believe in You. He can climb the highest mountain, swim to my widest sea. He can be whatever person he believes himself to be. Now, when I say a man can do these things, I hope you know that a woman, too, can match a man and go where he can go. So I'm speaking of mankind and of what this team can do if they both support each other and say, I believe in you. It's amazing how a person, though he thinks himself so small, when he knows someone's behind him, can dig down and give his all, and sometimes surprise himself at what he now can do. He has found this well of strength from an I Believe in You. Such a startling revelation when you've done all you can do to step back and see you've done all you really wanted to. And you know you owe the thanks for these dreams of yours come true to the faith of all the people who said, I believe in you. This, I think, was essentially my feeling on the podium, that I have vindicated their faith and trust in me. They supported me in every way except monetarily, which I didn't need.
Yeah, you know, some athletes are motivated by the people who told them what they couldn't do, and they say, oh, it's an I'll show you thing. And yours was the opposite perspective of, I'm going to vindicate the people who were behind me.
The relative importance of this was brought home to me after I'd been gone for about 2 months. I came back to Bloomington, and I said to one of my friends, boy, it's good to be back. And he said, where you been? I'm bringing an Olympic gold medal back from Australia. And he asked, where have you been?
He didn't know?
No.
It wasn't big news back here, was it?
No.
When you got back, was there a celebration in Terre Haute? Was there a parade?
Well, there was, yes. But bear in mind, it was December.
That's right, because the Australian Olympics were in November.
Yes. Yeah. As a matter of fact, it was on November 24th when I won.
So you had to drop out of school, didn't you?
Yes, I missed a semester, but I was able to pick it up in the summertime.
Now, you were on an athletic scholarship, right?
Yeah.
But you had to do some, you had to work in the snack bar.
Yeah, because my athletic scholarship paid me, I'm trying to remember, I think $25 a month to help defray their living expenses, and I was able to rent my books for a quarter of their costs. Now, I did have a little extra help. I was on the GI Bill, which helped me the first 4 years, because I had spent 2 years in service before. So it let us make ends meet. I think I owed about $5,000 when I got out compared to now.
Yeah, that's nothing. That's not a bad debt.
Yeah.
Well, how did the people in Terre Haute react when you got home from the Olympics?
Well,
anything in particular?
Yeah, they gave me a parade in a convertible to Garfield High School. They had something there. And there was a lot of animosity later on when Terry Dischinger came back. They really rolled out the red carpet.
He was on the 1960 Olympic basketball team.
Yes. And it was notable.
The difference.
Yeah, the difference. Mm. And I think someone heard it. So when Terry came back, they asked me to come down when they were giving him his accolades. And it was so obvious, though, it was blatant. And I don't really care. Now there is, I think it's still hanging there. They had a flag of me hang on the lamppost on Wabash Avenue. The people in the north end of town finally did something that I am really pleased about. They bought a little triangular tract of land about 2 blocks from the site of the old Garfield High School. And they wanted to name it Olympic Park, but they couldn't. So they named it Champions Park, because Garfield had the distinction of producing 3 successive Olympic gold medals. Clyde Lavellet in 52, me in 56, and Terry Dischinger in 60.
Yeah, that's unique.
And that is, probably some high schools in California might have matched that, but offhand I can't tell you any that have produced 3 successive Olympic gold medalists. So I'm glad they've got that, and I've got some pictures around here too, where they have erected some flag poles and three daises like this with beautiful bronze plaques of us on them. And it's a nice recognition, but what I think is the best part about it is up in that end of town where some of the kids growing up can see what we were able to do, and maybe I can.
Bell becomes a dentist, but not your run-of-the-mill dentist. And you might say he stops being a black man. That and more when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with Terre Haute native, IU grad, and Olympic gold medalist Greg Bell. He first set up his dental practice in Terre Haute, but found it difficult to run a business in his hometown. So he took a job at the Mental Hospital in Logansport, where he quickly earned the respect of his patients. He encountered another obstacle, though, when a skin condition stripped away his racial exterior. We haven't yet talked about your career in dentistry, and you mentioned where your interest in that began. So when you're done competing athletically, is that when you go to dental school?
No, I was a sophomore in dental school.
Okay.
No, I didn't have that luxury.
You began dental school when?
Actually, it was continuous. I enrolled at IU in 1954. Mm-hmm. And the first 3 years were doing all the undergraduate work, then the remainder actually in dental school proper. The first 3 years of dental school was done alongside the med school students.
Okay.
So, contrary to what most people think, and we've been referred to somewhat deprecatingly as tooth carpenters.
I've never heard that.
But it's much more than that, because the teeth are only a part of the whole. And so I was required to assist in three autopsies, and we had classes in developmental anatomy, histology, microbiology, exactly with the medical students. In fact, we dissected the same cadavers.
Wow.
So this was interesting to me because I enjoyed anatomy. Difficult topic, but I've always been curious to know how things work. And I would tear apart bicycles. How do they work?
Yeah.
So I think possibly it's this inquisitive mind that I have that has piqued my interest in so many different areas, because I do have an insatiable curiosity, and I'm never going to be bored because of too many things I haven't done and learned yet.
Yeah, so when did you become a dentist?
1961 is 61. The year I graduated.
So when you become a dentist, you work a year in Terre Haute, right?
Well, not right away. I went to Washington, D.C. I taught at Howard University's dental school for a year.
Oh, okay. You taught first.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was starving to death, too. They were not paying any salaries.
Yeah.
At all. And so I decided after a year, you know, if I'm going to starve, I'll do it on my own. So I went back to Terre Haute and opened a practice, and it was successful from the first day I opened.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there altogether from 61 to 69. But it turned out after about 2 years there, I discovered that about every fifth patient who came to my office either knew me when I was a kid, I was a friend of your mother's, I've known you since you were this high, wanting handouts. And I don't have any money. I don't know how successful it's going to be.
Yeah.
And I did not have the heart. I came up too poor to be charging people fees that they couldn't afford. So I said to my wife then, I said, you know, I need a salaried job. So I practiced there until 69, and she had taken her psychiatric nurse's training here in Logansport. She said, why don't you apply there? They have a dental department. So I did, and the personnel officer said, well, we don't have an opening now, but why don't you put in your formal application? I did. He called me the next week, said, our older dentist is going to retire early. How soon can you get here?
Oh, wow.
So I closed my practice, and we started packing up on August 13th. Came to Logansport, and I started work on the 15th.
So are you still a practicing dentist?
Yes. Okay. I am director of dental services.
Right.
At Logan Sports State Hospital.
So yeah, you take care of mentally ill patients.
Yes.
And criminals.
Yes.
What is that like? That's not your everyday job.
No, it's not your everyday job, but you get accustomed to it. It's when I first started there, I had few qualms, but I never had a big fear of it. And I find they're just people.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them really weird. Some of them quirky. Some are downright mean. But I have found that people respond much like you treat them. And all my time there, it'll be on the 15th of this month, it'll be 43 years. I have never been struck by a patient. And that's a claim few people can make.
I bet.
But I treat them with as much respect as they will permit. I'm not easy. I let them know, no, in this particular place, your behavior is not negotiable. You will cooperate with me. I'll break my back to help you. But the minute you refuse to cooperate, my next word to you is goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple. Years ago, I had a patient who just wanted to be obstreperous, and I was going to fill a tooth for him. And I had made the preparation, and the tooth was laying wide open. He decided he wasn't going to let me fill it. I didn't argue with him. Bye. 3 hours later, he was begging.
I bet.
He didn't do that again.
Yeah.
So I treat them humanely, but I'm not soft.
We were talking earlier, before we began the show, about your skin condition. You're a black man, and you have a skin condition now where you are...
It's called vitiligo.
Vitiligo.
Yeah.
That's what Michael Jackson said he had, right?
Yeah, and that's bullshit.
Yeah, I didn't think he really did, but...
No, because you've never seen anyone with vitiligo. It's got uniformly light.
Yeah.
It spots.
When did this condition begin?
I can pinpoint it pretty exactly because at about age 40, and I don't know if it's hereditary, but it seemed to be at least familial. My father had this.
Okay.
And apparently it began about the age with him. I can remember when it began because I remember when I moved to Logansport, I wasn't quite 40. And I looked in the mirror, I had one white hair in my mustache, so I pulled it out. And it wasn't long after that I started getting little spots. For years, I've had a white streak in my hair, and I suspect this was the beginning of it then. So this is one of those things that it's disfiguring. It's really horrible for very dark-skinned people. And often it begins around the eyes. It seems to begin where there's more wrinkled or irritation, and then it just spreads. White people have it as well.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't notice it as much.
But it's interesting, really, for a black person who grew up with certain prejudices that you faced growing up to kind of become a white person.
Yes, and I make jokes about this.
Yeah.
Yeah, after living the first 40 years of my life as an African-American, I'm going to see how the other half lives. I'm going to be turning white.
Do people treat you any differently, thinking that you're...
No. First of all, because so many of them have known me.
They know.
Yeah. But I don't try to pass because I'm who I am. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter. I don't want to be associated with ghettoese because that's not who I am. And we grew up very poor, but I was fortunate in that we... were surrounded by white people. And so I didn't have that weighing on me where I had to conform, or I had to do this or that. And I found people tend to treat you like you teach them to treat you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm no pushover. I used to have an almost homicidal temper, and I've learned to curb it to some extent. But my philosophy has been now, I like people, but I don't require them. I don't demand that the world love me. If you like me, great. If you don't, all I ask, leave me alone. That is about as simple as I can make it, because my friends accept me in spite of my faults. If you're not my friend, I'm not going to waste an awful lot of time worrying about it. So I would love for everybody I meet to like me, and for the most part, they do, because I don't do things that would cause you to dislike me, unless you don't like straight talk, because I will do that always. But this is who I am, and I couldn't be otherwise if I tried. Yes, I can pretend, I can play politics, and I can do these things, but that's not who I am.
Was it at all, at first, disconcerting to have your skin color change like that?
Oh, very disconcerting.
I would think so.
Yeah,
I have
certainly as much pride as most people, and it's disfiguring. I had a pretty nice-looking complexion, and all of a sudden, that's gone, and I look like a clown. And I tried to hide it. I have used all kinds of dyes. The best that I finally found was called Vita dye. It helped, but it also, even though it was pretty foolproof, it rubs off. Well, I've destroyed more shirts trying to camouflage it, and I finally decided, why? At this point, if I had a choice, would I change back? Yeah. In fact, I say, I don't care what color. I'd just like to be a color.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that I have learned. For those things that you have no control over, you would do well to accept them, because if you can't change it, you can drive yourself nuts. And what value is that?
More of the Greg Bell Story when One-on-One continues.
We're back on One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Hey, thanks to Greg Bell for adding his story to the One-on-One library. And quite a story it is, eh? Kid grows up in poverty, is forced to move to a high school where he can compete in track, gets back into the sport by a fluke circumstance while in the Army, goes back home to work in a factory, and then is led back to athletics because of a fluke meeting with a family doctor. He wins an Olympic gold medal, becomes a dentist, and I guess you could say he finds a unique way to transcend race. There's a lot more I can tell you about, too. He's not only a poet, as you heard during the episode, he's a skilled craftsman. He built a 20-foot by 14-foot gazebo in his backyard in Logansport. He built the impressive desk in his office. He built the bench I sat on while we talked. He's built ornate walking sticks for his wife. And he built the wooden container for his gold medal, which he cut into the shape of Australia. And if you've seen Australia lately, you know that isn't easy. And oh yeah, he's written an autobiography, and he drew the illustrations for it. He also creates some impressive computer art. I could go on, but I think you get the point. Check out his website sometime at www.gold56.org. That's G-O-L-D-56.org. You'll learn more about his life and see photographs that illustrate his career. Now, as always, you can hear this or any of the other One-on-One episodes on our website at 1070thefan.com. Click on shows, click on weekly shows, click on the One-on-One link, and click on the podcast link, and you'll have access to all the conversations with Indiana sporting legends. I can be reached by email at mark@1070thefan.com, and my Twitter handle is @MarkMonteith. Next week, I'll come back with another conversation with the Hoosier Olympian, diving coach Hobie Billingsley. That's next week, right here on 1070 The Fan.